Hey everybody, this is Matt. We don't do a lot of electoral politics on our podcasts, but as 2020 approaches, there are important questions being asked about the relationship between system-level or revolutionary politics and electoral politics. Emma Catron is a member of DSA, Democratic Socialist of America's Socialist Majority Caucus, and is engaged in a fierce nationwide discussion among DSA members on whether to endorse Bernie Sanders' campaign, assuming that Bernie Sanders does in fact decide to run for president. Full disclosure, I'm a member of DSA, and I'm on the fence about whether DSA should be endorsing a candidate in this presidential race, and I really like Bernie Sanders' policy platform. Emma Catron published a piece called The Bernie Advantage on February 8th. Her piece can be found at socialistmajority.com, and again, it's called The Bernie Advantage, and we've linked it in our episode description. Now, to those outside of DSA, this might seem like a trivial or amusing question. To those inside, it's a question of where we want to put our resources and our energy, and whether we want to affix ourselves to the identity and political fate of a powerful politician who's, to be honest, not probably as far to the left as a substantial portion of DSA's 55K membership. Don't get me wrong. Bernie Sanders has an amazing policy platform. As a president, would be in a position to implement or influence an agenda. Nevertheless, the endorsement question is not a simple one. There's a lot of pushback on it, including among members that I've talked to here in the Midwest and Mountain West. So to further discussion, I interviewed Emma, and we talked about her piece and the many issues underlying this question. And if other folks in DSA, hopefully folks who are writing the other way on this question, publishing the other way on this question, in whatever format, if they want to join me or join us in a subsequent podcast, please know that that invitation is absolutely open. We even talk about it in the interview. And here we go. Let's go ahead and listen to our interview with Emma Catron.
Beyond the actual arguments, of which there are many arguments back and forth, why do you think that so many DSA comrades struggle with this question and this kind of question? If you were to step into the shoes of the folks that feel like we, you know, should not be in the business of endorsing Bernie in particular, or are endorsement skeptics in general, where do you feel like some of their concerns come from?
I've actually been in those shoes because in 2015, I believe, October 2015, I wrote an article for a publication called Truth Out that was entitled, Is Bernie Sanders Dangerous for Socialism? And it was a question very much in that sort of Fox News vein of rhetorical questions, where my obvious implication was, yes, he is dangerous to socialism. And particularly, it was his reference to Dwight D. Eisenhower as this good president, and then also his reference to police officers being the sort of public institutions that we would want supported under socialism.
Sure.
I was like, these things aren't socialism. This guy is going around and people are listening to him, and they're going to get the wrong idea of what socialism is, and that will be bad. That concern has never entirely left me. It's still, it's still something that I try to vigorously put out there as often as possible. I have people all the time in person or on Twitter or even email questions to me, saying things like, socialism is just, you know, libraries and public schools. And I'm like, oh, not quite, actually. And, you know, try to explain to them that socialism is really about democratic control over the economy and society, and establishing rules by and for the working class population, which is currently subjugated by a elite, wealthy class of people who run this country. Mm-hmm. So I very much understand the perspective. And of course, you know, the biggest reason why I was against Bernie Sanders in 2016 was a friend of mine who was very active in Palestinian liberation struggles. And she was just, you know, she was just livid that people were talking about Bernie Sanders as this almost messiahic figure, and we're not mentioning the fact that he has had these terrible positions as to the state of Israel, which is an apartheid state. It's committed innumerable human rights abuses that are just as bad as, you know, the things that Trump proposes. I mean, they've had their own wall for quite a while now. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, many people have characterized Gaza as an open air prison. I don't think that's an exaggeration at all. So yes, I feel like I do understand the perspective of most people who oppose the Bernie endorsement. And, you know, that's why the caucus that I'm in, DSA Socialist Majority, when we were trying to think of what things we wanted to put out into the universe, you know, I proposed to my comrades, I was like, I think it would be good for me to put out a piece that kind of laid out the sort of logical reasoning that got me from that place of being a Bernie endorsement skeptic to being someone who vigorously supports a mm-hmm. Bernie Sanders 2020 endorsement.
But for reasons that feel very pragmatic to me, in terms of at least assuming that the premises of your argument are true, then it seems like it's not, you know, you are not a Bernie cheerleader so much as an advocate of endorsement for really very strategic reasons.
Yeah, I'm a DSA cheerleader. If there's, you know, one thing that I am obnoxiously advocating for at all times, it's DSA. I really believe in this organization and believe that we can do great things. Bernie Sanders, I think, is a good outlet for us to get the things that we need to make the advancements that we need to do as an organization to become a mass organization for the working class, both in terms of what someone like Bernie Sanders could do once they have the presidency, as well as the benefits of participating in his campaign, sort of the people we would be able to reach, and the sort of real-time experience that would give our members in terms of canvassing, in terms of talking to people about political issues. You know, it's funny. I've lived in a few different places. I grew up in a small town in Virginia, and it was the first place I ever did canvassing. Now I'm here in Brooklyn, and it's a whole lot different. I'll just say that, you know, I was commiserating with a friend from Florida And we were both talking about canvassing for the Employee Free Choice Act back in, I think, like 2006, maybe around that time. Mm-hmm. You know, talking about how we would knock on doors sometimes and people would call us communists for supporting labor unions.
I have some understanding of that out here in Wyoming, where they still hang horse thieves and communists.
Yikes. Yeah. And, you know, obviously that stuff is terrifying, but, you know, that's ultimately the work that we need to be doing if we really want to be a working class organization. You know, the working class is, in the United States, even now, although it's gotten a lot better, the working class still has a very low level of class consciousness. They still are very susceptible to arguments that other things are responsible for their problems. You know, people are still susceptible to those arguments and also still susceptible to the sort of illusions of capitalism. You know, one of the arguments that the right wing is really trotting out right now to oppose the Green New Deal is, you know, this is against using airplane travel. The vast majority of people in the U.S. haven't flown on a plane in the last year. And they probably know that, but the thing is that they're not targeting people who've flown on a plane in the last year. They're targeting people who think, oh yeah, one day, you know, when I've made it, when I'm successful, I'm going to be wanting to jet around in my nice plane, like, you know, a rock star or whatever.
Personally, I'm looking forward to riding the sustainable dirigibles that they bring back. Or really a whole, you know, bunch of different things, or like a super train of some kind, you know, that has, you know, maybe like runs on double tracks and has like a dance hall in it or something. I'm actually very excited to not fly on airplanes anymore, if that's really part of the deal. It's like, where do I sign that part of the Green New Deal? I am personally on the fence about this discussion, even though I am often a pragmatic compromise person compared to some of the other comrades out here. And their argument, or the argument of those here who are opposed to the endorsement, is one of resources. They wonder if those resources could be better spent on things like chapter building, especially maybe in places like Nebraska and Wyoming and places like that, where there are a lot of rural challenges, but at the same time, where a powerful chapter could do a lot of good in both local politics and maybe even in turning states around as well. So it's a resource argument. What do you think about that?
Yeah, so I've heard this feedback from a couple of people in regards to my article, and it's not the focus of my article because, you know, I personally am not privy to the sort of fiscal mechanics of our national organization. That being said, the caucus that I'm a part of and that put out this article, DSA Socialist Majority, we're really a caucus that's all about chapter building. And what we're trying to get across to people is our belief that this is a false dichotomy to say, you know, oh, we shouldn't do Bernie 2020, we should do chapter building. Because the thing is Bernie 2020 can be chapter building. Now, I'm not gonna tell you that it by itself is chapter building. We need to have a plan. We need to intervene in the campaign in the way that we want to. But I know that we've heard from Bernie Sanders people in the know that if we did endorse, that we would have very wide flexibility in terms of how we wanted to go about campaigning for him. And so with that flexibility, what my caucus, DSA Socialist Majority, would hope to do is to use the campaign to build up the resources of local chapters. You know, there will be a Bernie Sanders campaign in Wyoming, but even if, you know, his people are neglecting Wyoming, that is not what we want, because I think what was most appealing to DSA for me and for a lot of people is that we're not like these other socialist organizations which only exist in major metropolitan cities. We have chapters all across the country, and I want to build those chapters so socialism is unavoidable. They don't have anywhere to go anymore. I mean, that's always, you know, I saw that firsthand doing union work in Virginia, where Northrop Grumman, for example, moved to the Tidewater area, which is where I'm from, specifically to get around union stuff. You know, they were, when we don't have, when we only have these sort of progressive hubs in certain states and certain cities, it allows them to just export their exploitation elsewhere, and you know, we don't want them to be able to do that. We want them to be met at every avenue with us.
So this is the what I think is the crux of your argument, and so I'm going to read it and kind of ask a question also, or sort of make an observation about also sort of where I think this debate is. Anyway, I'm babbling. You write, at this point, some endorsement opponents will likely revert to the main argument they have made, that Bernie Sanders has bad policy positions on imperialism, racism, sex work, and so on. We of course should not trivialize these issues. The predominating ideas have resulted in very real deprivation and loss of human life, but it is important to realize that policy positions are not the same as political gains. After all, my fervent belief in a one-state solution and the end of Israeli apartheid do not produce much political gain by themselves. Political gain must be viewed through the lens of material relationships of power, and with Sanders 2020, we are talking about nothing less than the president of the United States. And you go on to talk about the nature of presidential power, and I think we've seen that in uniquely negative ways with this administration. Although we don't want to let past administrations and more sterile or sterilized looking administrations off the hook. But I think in the Venn diagram of DSA comrades against endorsing Bernie and people who don't believe Donald Trump's presidency has had a uniquely negative impact, I have a feeling there's probably not a lot of separation between those circles. And so in an offhand way, I feel like there's a little bit of accelerationism sometimes in the anti-endorsement position. How much do you think this is a question of maybe a sort of phantom accelerationism, or sometimes not so subtle accelerationism on people's part?
Today's empires are tomorrow's ashes, you know. But with that in mind. I'm not sure if I would go so far as to categorize at least most of the arguments as being accelerationist. But I do think that these arguments come from a very understandable cynicism. I mean, I worked on the Affordable Care Act. I was one of the nerds who believed that it was going to be the stepping stone to single-payer healthcare, and it wasn't. We were wrong. And I think, we've learned from those mistakes. We've learned that a liberal president isn't good enough. We've learned that grassroots organizations shouldn't put someone into office and then disband, that they should be constantly putting pressure on people. And, One thing I actually hear a lot of times with when this argument comes up is, well, if Bernie Sanders gets elected, he won't be able to do anything like Obama. You know, he'll have his hands tied like Obama's were tied. And, you know, honestly, like, fuck that argument, you know? It's just like,
Obama's hands were not as tied as tightly right. as people think. And he could have, I mean, I had this fantasy about, you know, what if, I mean, at one time, Obama could have put 1 million people on the DC Mall, you know, at the cusp of his sort of campaign effectiveness or campaigning effectiveness, he could put 2 million people on the DC Mall if he'd have wanted. And what if all of those people were holding up single payer signs? And what does that do to the conversation? I always feel like I call that the Obama counterfactual. It's this idea that, you know, actually he could have done something like that. People would have freaked out. Obviously, conservatives would have freaked out, but you know they freaked out anyway.
And you know the Trump administration, for all of its bumbling oafishness when it comes to the legislative process, which it's been a complete failure at getting anything done in terms of through Congress, it's had enormous success for its objectives in the federal government, especially the administrative side of the federal mm-hmm. government.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have the most ambitious deregulation agenda of all time. It will be the biggest destruction of public wealth of all time. And what's even more interesting for someone like me, I believe strongly that we have to study the far right, not just to know who our enemy is, but also to see what they do that works and what powers they're able to utilize. And, you know, one of the things that they've done recently with Venezuela is seizing oil companies and public assets of oil companies in Venezuela. And so, you know, when centrists tell me, you know, that we can't go to zero fossil fuels in a matter of years, I'm like, bullshit. Mm-hmm. We could. Because these fossil fuel companies, I mean, you know, Nicolas Maduro mm-hmm. has mm-hmm. Obviously done some things that warrant scrutiny and accountability, but he hasn't done anything compared to Shell, compared to BP, mm-hmm, in mm-hmm. terms of the mass destruction of life, in terms of fostering terrorist organizations like Boko Haram in Nigeria. There is a wide basis for shutting down the oil companies and prosecuting their executives, frankly. But I'm just using this as an example of the president has a lot of power. We are a constitutional republic. We're not a parliamentary democracy like some European countries. And aside from a couple of examples like France, which has a very strong presidency as well, we have one of the strongest executive branches in the world. And of course, it's the executive branch of the United States and the particular powers that come with that, especially the military. You know, I didn't talk about this so much in the piece, but I also look at this as a duty that we have to the rest of the world. I mean, we're bombing the rest of the world. A very considerable portion of the world is constantly under our military aggression. And we have a responsibility to do whatever it takes to end that. And electing Bernie Sanders, I mean, he hasn't had the best policies when in regards to imperialism. There's a lot of stuff that I would like to push him on, but he is by and far the best candidate in terms of the current selection. Certainly better than, say, Elizabeth Warren, who's kind of his second most progressive challenger. Her policies towards imperialism have not moved in the same way that Bernie Sanders have. Mm-hmm. She did vote against the anti-BDS bill. I'll give her credit for that. But overall, her policies have remained very much the same, which is promoting the apartheid state of Israel and promoting broad law enforcement powers to fight this fake trumped up war on terror, which is just an excuse to exploit and oppress a large portion of the world.
Has your caucus considered situations or possibilities where DSA endorsement might hurt a candidate?
You know, I'm not sure if we have talked about that particular scenario. Our caucus is lucky to have some incredibly experienced and intelligent members who have done campaigns that I'm sure some of your listeners are familiar with, like Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Our focus is really on using electoral campaigns to build the power of our organization. So, you know, we have one of our members said to me recently, he said, you know, if you endorse someone and they lose, but they get 40% of the vote, that's a win for us. So even if they wind up losing the race overall, the fact that they're able to get so close gets us a lot of media attention, gets us a lot of opportunities in terms of canvassing, in terms of building connections with other organizations that might be working on the campaign.
Mm-hmm. I guess the counterproductivity thing is not really a DSA question. It's a question about that candidate.
And I mean, I think this is, you know, something that maybe smaller chapters and chapters that are in more conservative states might find appealing about a Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign is, I certainly know in the Tidewater area in Virginia that all the Democrats who run there are like veterans and they all like have friends in the payday loan industry, and they're just like someone, and they all do blackface apparently now, so apparently, yeah. That's a whole thing.
If anyone is willing to bite the huge red apple that we have on a string, you know, in terms of concluding this interview and on the podcast, and maybe come on and give the other side or some other sides to, you know, to this question, would you be willing to go another round maybe sometime somewhere down the line?
Absolutely. I mean, one thing that we're hoping to sort of set ourselves apart with DSA socialist majority is we're trying to be like the friendly caucus. It sounds kind of corny, but you know, we really believe that in order to be a mass party of the working class, we have to be willing to work with people who have different perspectives on different issues. There are plenty of people in our caucus who have different views on different policies, ideas, things like that. The reason why we came together is because of our common belief that the way that you should engage in national campaigns like Bernie Sanders 2020, like Medicare for All, like abolishing ICE. But then you should engage in those campaigns, not in a top-down way. We don't think the national should be giving orders to the rest of the chapters. We believe the national should be going to chapters and say, what do you need to make this campaign a reality? The national should be going to chapters and saying, you know, here are some campaigns we're working on. Do you want to work on any of these? And if you don't, what are you working on? What can we help you to build?
Emma Catron, and thank you very much again for doing this on short notice. And I'm going to try to post this in the next 24 hours if I can. And so great. I will share it with you, and we'll let the games begin.
Our caucus is very excited, and if anyone has any questions for me, I'm on Twitter at Emma Catron DSA. Feel free to tweet at me, slide into the DMs, as it were. and then you can find out more about our caucus at socialistmajority.com.
Hey everybody, Solidarity House Cooperative is now on iTunes and Spotify, as well as Podbean and Patreon. You can go to Patreon to support us and any of those platforms to hear us.